little bit tongue in cheek, but also maybe I'm being very serious. That sounds completely un-American to me, that there would be.
Hello, this is Liliana.
I'm Danaya.
And I'm Badila.
And we're from Perfect 10 After School,
a wonderful club for girls in Hudson, New York.
And you're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, ACRA.
Community radio for Columbia and Greene counties.
Perfect 10 girls got it going on.
Oh, yeah.
Do you like music? Do you read books too? Then WGXC and me, local noisemaker and music writer Sal Cataldi, have a show for you. It's called Reading is Functamental. Every month we interview the authors of the greatest books ever written about music across all genres and eras, from Sly Stone to Coltrane, Black Sabbath to Bach, ambient to easy listening. So make a date to join us the second Wednesday of every month at 10 a.m. for Reading is Functamental.
Wave Farms WGXC is made possible in part by the generous support of Carmen Borgia of Catskill, New York. WGXC supporters care deeply about creative community radio. Their generosity and investment keep this unique station viable. You too can become a monthly supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. and establishing a donation at the amount of your choosing. We hope you will do so. Thank you so much for your support.
WGXC underwriting is provided in part by The Highway Drive-In, a four-screen drive-in movie theater in Coxsackie, New York. Information and schedule at HIWAYDriveIn.com.
90.7 FM.
ACRA, Hudson, Catskill.
Make you remind, and in was Alan Sparhawk and Trampled by Turtles. The track Get Still. I'm Justin Maiman. This is Ginger Radio Hour. You're listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 FM. And today, how to survive a bear attack with Claire Cameron. She'll be joining us from Toronto via Zoom. And I've got to go figure out how to make all that happen. So I'm going to do that. And we'll speak with Claire Cameron in a few minutes. Until then, let's listen to some Old Joy.
Thank you.
Excellent, excellent. Claire, this is Justin. Hello, can you hear me?
Hi, Justin. Yes, I can.
Excellent. Everybody here in the Catskills, Claire Cameron has joined me via Zoom from Toronto. So as I mentioned earlier in the show, Claire Cameron just wrote this tremendous book called How to Survive a Bear Attack, a memoir. And I have many ways of introducing this book. I've told people, I've called it a literary page-turner, a murder mystery, but also like a nature writing wildlife investigation. But it's also a very personal story. It's all these things at once. But maybe, Claire, you could, let's give you a chance to kind of describe what you've created here.
Okay. So I think that's right. It's definitely, it's almost like a true crime investigation of a bear attack. And I started that. So bear attacks, we should be clear right off the bat, especially with black bears, as a lot of your listeners know, are extremely rare. And there was this one particular attack that happened in 1991 that had always haunted me. And it was really when I was diagnosed with cancer. I have a rare mutation, a genetic mutation, that means I have a propensity to have cancer. It was when I was diagnosed with that that I started investigating this bear attack. And it's like the rareness of both instances kind of came together in this book. So it's fundamentally about how terror can rip through a beautiful place that I love, or how the same can happen in a life.
That is so much better than I would have done. Thank you. You talk a lot about wilderness and wildness in the book, and I want to get to that in a little bit. But one of the things I thought would be helpful for people who haven't read the book is for you to give everybody, you're a paddler. You're somebody who grew up going out into the woods. You ended up being a climber as well and all these other things. So I'm wondering if you could just describe your background a little bit in the wilderness.
Yeah, I started canoeing. It was actually the White River that got me hooked. The White River's like flows into Lake Superior, which is the biggest Great Lake. It's actually an inland sea. It's so big. So I took the White River into by canoe and ended up in Superior. We had to wait 3 days actually because the waves were so big. Like, you know that Gordon Lightfoot song, The Wreck of the Edmunds Fitzgerald?
Sure,
that's a little Canadiana for you. But it like, the Superior's that big, it takes down ships. So we had to wait for about 3 days. And then when we finally got out on the canoe, there's three or four canoes, I think. And I just remember looking beside me and seeing the canoe beside me, like, way overhead on a roller and then going down. And, it was, like, way down below me. It was the power of that water. I just couldn't get over it, and I never forgot it. So from that moment on, I was in a canoe any moment I could, and that kind of led to rock climbing, in the Niagara Escarpment and things around Ontario. And then I went out west, I started mountain climbing, and it was all from there. I work for an organization called Outward Bound in Oregon, and climbed all through California and lived out there for a while too. So I really have the outdoor bug. It's sort of, it's where I met my husband. I have two boys, taking them canoeing all over the place is a very central part of my life.
So I grew up partly in Minnesota, and we used the BWCA, the Boundary Waters Canoe Area, and also Quetico.
Yeah, exactly.
So I spent a lot of time in those places in my teens and 20s. And one of the things that I don't know that people understand when we talk about these places, these wild places, is how vast they are, and how it is a place where humans and animals and wildlife kind of coexist and come together. But really, it's a place not for humans.
Yeah, that's true. There's not that many places in the world like that anymore. Certainly, I mean, in Canada, we often talk about up north. Like, I'm pointing to the sky. I don't even know where it is, but it's that idea that you go north from the border and it's just like open. So we often say, like, yeah, we're going north to sort of talk about a place like the Boundary Waters. And it's sort of Always to me been like an almost an orientation. It's like where the wilderness is and where the wild is and where I want to go whenever I can. It's a real like sort of, you know, a direction that I headed for my whole life.
And specifically, especially for the book, the setting is, I believe it's Algonquin Park. Is that right?
Yeah, Algonquin Park. Yes.
And can you explain to people how big that is?
Yeah, it's, well, I think I say in the book, it's like half the size of New Jersey or Cyprus or Puerto Rico. Like it's like its own country almost. And it was formed around the same time, like Yellowstone, you know, that sort of park was. It's it was one of those 1893, I guess, in Canada. And it's one of our many parks, but it's quite a famous one because it's fairly accessible from Toronto, about 3 hours north. And it's full of lakes and canoes, like thousands and thousands of lakes and rivers that people go canoe tripping through. So it's a lot like the Boundary Waters. It looks quite similar. And the Canadian Shield's all through it. Yeah.
And so if this is a true crime investigation, that is where much of the action is happening, correct?
Yeah.
So there's really, I think, like three parallel stories. I don't know if a trio of things can be in parallel, but I think they can. They're all running alongside each other, and you do a really nice job. And I'm going to quote you here to yourself, but also to our listeners. that you say, early on in the book, you say, my investigation follows three main lines of inquiry. The bear is the most important. This took me years to understand, but it was his decision that changed everything that came after. The couple are also important, as are the people who were in the search party, but they are only part of this story because they were in a certain place at a specific time. I am the third line of inquiry. I wasn't directly involved in what happened, but my interest has been led by personal circumstances. So can you elaborate a little bit on then what you do in the book and what happens?
Yeah. So there's the three strands. Fundamentally, this is an investigation of a bear attack that happened in 1991 in Algonquin Park. There was a couple, so Canadian Thanksgiving's in mid-October. We do it a bit earlier. There was a couple who went on the Friday for a long weekend. They were back country camping. And they left the dock at 5:30 on Friday, and they were never seen again. A search party went to the island on the Tuesday to look for them, and there was a black bear that came out and charged the search party. And it was later that they found the bodies of the couple. It was so shocking. I was working at a summer camp at the park. It was so shocking in 91 because we generally thought like grizzlies are the bears that you spend time worrying about, but this was a black bear. My experience of black bears was that they sometimes lick the barbecue if you didn't scrub it off properly, and then you clap and they run away. Like I thought of them as sort of overgrown raccoons. And this attack was on the front page of our national paper, the Globe and Mail, and the bear was called 308 pounds of black fury. And, you know, I thought of the like little bear cubs I saw around camp and stuff. I couldn't put those two things together. It happened on an island called Bates Island, which sounded, you know, that sounded like a horror movie, like Hitchcock to me. So it was kind of this thing. I went back to camp the next summer and I was asking what happened because it made no sense. And I heard the strangest details, like there was a broken paddle found at the front of the campsite. And the implication was that there'd been some kind of struggle. Another one was that there was a tray of ground beef found on the ring of rocks around the fireplace at the campsite. And the bear was there and he hadn't touched the ground beef. So that was just kind of like, you know, that felt significant, but I wasn't sure what to do with it. So that was kind of, I always kind of wondered. I wrote a novel in 2014 that was kind of based on, I'd been in San Francisco and then I moved to London, England for a while and I was moving back to Canada and I had kids and I was a little worried about taking them to Algonquin Park. And I thought, you know, am I scared of bears or what's happening? So I just kind of wrote, I decided I was more worried about being vulnerable as a parent. So I wrote the bear my 2014 novel, just sort of from those like nightmarish sort of things, ghost stories I'd almost heard about the attack. Anyway, so this book though is comes very much from sort of a investigative point of view. But I, as I started writing, I realized that I was writing yet another book where the big bad bear comes at the end and attacks. And, you know, I just didn't feel that the world needs another book like that, that villainizes bears, because I love bears. I've studied bears for 30 years. So it was actually a wildlife biologist that I was working with, who sort of challenged me on that. And this is when I was in draft one, probably, and there was about five, so early on. But he said to me, you know, I was talking him through what I was doing, and he said, well, are you going to make this bear into a demon? And I realized I had the story of this innocent couple, and I knew kind of what happened, but then who was the bad guy? You know, it kind of, and I was uncomfortable with it. So I actually quit the book for a while. But then a couple years later, I had the idea of trying to understand the bear's perspective, which sounds ridiculous, but my take on the bear is based in science. And again, I was working with a wildlife biologist who said, oh, you can get to know a bear and you can understand them. You need to follow their stomachs. You know, bears wake up every day and they're feeding themselves off the land. And that, you know, if you want to know a bear, that's what you do. So there's those are the two arcs. There's the investigation, which is from when the couple leaves the dock to what happened. You know, I get into sort of the scene and the evidence and things. And then the second strand is a year in the bear of the year in the life of the bear leading up to the attack. And it's, yeah, it's really his story of what he eats. It really is. And where he travels through the year in the cycle.
So let me interject really quick, Claire. So before we get to the third strand, which is you and your story, you really did get inside the head of a bear. And when you started doing it, and for the listeners, there are, you know, chapters devoted to the bear's point of view in this book. When it began, I didn't know that you'd be able to pull it off. It was a big surprise to me. And
when I hear it now, I'm embarrassed. Like I...
You can't, no, but you shouldn't be, because there are, I don't know if you've ever read The Story of a Goat, by Perumal Murugan, which is very similar, just like the goat. This is, you know, the primary character in the story. So I think you can absolutely do it. It's just, I think, a little bit shocking for a reader. But you totally pulled it off. But I imagine it must have felt, maybe not because you've written fiction, but it must have felt like you were taking a little bit of a chance here.
So I actually... A friend who's a writer actually said to me recently, he was like, so when you pitched that part to your editor, how did that go? And the trick there is I didn't even really admit it to myself. We have a place sort of just north of Toronto, and I locked myself in there for 3 weeks and like turned off my modem. And I just knew I had to do it. And I had so much research about bears. And, you know, there's been studies where they've tracked large males all through Algonquin Park and outside too. So I could pick one of those ranges and just write to that. And I've been in Algonquin Park. I know the land really well. So it actually came, it was like the easiest part. I found it much easier to write about the bear's life than I found it was to write about mine, quite frankly. Like it really came naturally. And it is sort of like it's underpinned with science the whole way through, you know, so it didn't feel as absurd as it kind of sounds.
and I should say that it helps you underline, you know, not making this effect of the big bad bear. Because we get a real, like you said, the bear is led by its stomach. And so you get the sense of like through the seasons, the bear wakes up and this is what they're looking for is enough calories.
And what his challenges are day to day, which are many, right? Like they have a hard life.
So I thought it really worked. And I'm so glad it was a part of the book, because I think it's important if you're trying to recreate this thing that happened, and you have evidence, obviously, and some facts. But then there are some other things you have to do, too. And there was not much evidence about the bear itself, except at the scene, correct?
Well, they did a necropsy, like an autopsy that they do on animals. So there's quite a bit of information in that. And then I was working with the two biologists that did a study of large male black bears after this attack, and they did a 5-year study. So I actually, and so they hadn't followed this bear, but they had actually, you know, because this was like collars tracking. So they were out there crawling around and stuff. So I actually could learn quite a bit. I mean, the key to it is what all the bear biologists kept telling me, that it took me a little while to understand, is that bears are individuals and they do individual things. So we often talk about wild animals as like a species and what their characteristics of their species are. So when one does something that's outside of the range of what we think that should be, it's, you know, called a rogue bear, or there's something wrong with it, or whatever else. But when you start looking at this guy in 1991, he was an individual and he made a very unusual decision that most black bears wouldn't make. But it was very consistent with the kind of bear he was, which was a older, large male black bear who's taken a lot of chances to get where he is. Because the large bear, the bigger you are in bear world, the more you get to mate. And that's kind of where he was going for the spring. Yeah.
And did you ever name him in your head as a way to...
Oh, that's such an interesting question. I never even thought of it. Because I just saw him through his eyes, kind of. I didn't really think of him. And I don't think he would think of himself as having a name.
Right.
Like, yeah. So I guess I did think that through a little, but yeah.
Well, so I know sometimes it's hard for people to understand if they haven't read the book, but I think this is really one of the highlights of what you've done. But also, you then managed to weave in your personal story. And so maybe you can talk a little bit about that, because... You were going through a really a tough moment.
Yes. So I actually did that last. So this book came in layers, and we kind of described the first two. The last people kept, so I had the bear and the investigation coming together, and people kept saying to me, like my agent, Richard Pine, is in New York and he's in Manhattan. And he kept saying things like, so if I talk about this bear attack in Canada, everyone's going to know what I'm talking about. And I was like, oh, not really. Like, it's not. So when people read the draft, they were like, but why are you so obsessed with this bear attack? Like, what is it with you and bears, is one of my best friends said. I started to realize that my obsession with this attack was so integral to the story. So I've talked a bit about how I'm an avid outdoors person. I sort of got attached to the outdoors because my dad died. It was quite a direct thing. When I was young, and 9 years old, he had skin cancer, melanoma, and it spread. And he died. Like, just, it was a horrible, I'm sure some of the people listening have experience with cancer in the 80s. The treatment was just brutal. It looked like sort of a nuclear event or something. So I kind of went numb, and I recovered on this trip in the White River and, you know, in paddling and climbing and mountains and everything else. It was the thing that sort of reattached me to life and to people again. And it was the way I coped with anything hard. You know, if anything bad happened, I'd just jump in a canoe and go. I'd come back and it would be solved. So when I was 45, I found a black spot on my shoulder, and it was melanoma. And it turned out that I had 4 instances of melanoma, and which is rare for someone who's 45. And I did a genetic test, and they realized that I have, it's called the CDKN2 gene. And it means that the cell replication cycle in me doesn't stop like it does in most people. So I'm prone to skin cancer and some other kinds too. My surgeon said to me, you know, this means you're going to have to be dealing with cancer probably for the rest of your life. And your genetics is the thing that's going to dictate the course of your disease, probably. But there's one thing you can do, and that's stay out of the sun. And I sort of started laughing like a crazy lady. Like, I just couldn't. I was like, but it's me. I've got to go in the sun because that's what I do. And he said, you know, it's, I know that's impossible. You're a human and we're, you know, creatures of the daytime, but you absolutely have to aim in that direction. So I started to realize that that was, you know, anything that's on my bucket list or my coping mechanism, all I wanted to do was get in a canoe, go to Algonquin Park to, you know, get my head back together. And those were the exact things that I couldn't do anymore. So it was in sort of, I felt like there was, I guess also I was 45 and my dad had died at 42. So I didn't see, our fates felt so intertwined. So I was like waiting for my oncology report and the email to know if my cancer had spread. And I got just obsessed with this bear attack again. Specifically, I read that there was an oar or a paddle found at the front of the campsite. And that detail, I was so stuck on it because, and I'm not saying this is normal. This was like, this was just where I was at the moment. I got so stuck on that because a paddle that you canoe with is like 2 or 3 pounds. It's kind of light. You know, they sometimes have cracks. They can break on the rocks. I could see why there was like a split paddle, but if it was an oar, they're more like 5 to 8 pounds and you use them like in an oar lock to like pull water. They're much heavier. And I was thinking, what kind of confrontation broke an oar that I just couldn't get up? So that became like paddle or oar. I just had to answer that question. That kind of kickstarted everything. So it became a book really about dealing with like hard things and coping with hard things that happen in life and how to continue on, I guess.
One of the sentences I wrote down that you use later in the book is the strength to be brave.
Right.
Which I thought was, you were talking about it from your perspective as a human who is facing death, like all of us are, but it's yeah, much more in the forefront. And it occurred to me that that's what's happening to each of the main characters in this book. We already know the fate of the bear and the couple. When you talk about the importance of being brave, I imagine that that didn't come naturally. I don't think any of us are naturally brave in the face of a cancer diagnosis.
Yeah. I mean, one of the bravest things, I had this moment where my husband and I went to the campsite where the attack happened. And we went in October because I wanted to see like this, how the light worked and what the foliage was like and that sort of thing. And we were paddling there. And I'd always been told, you know, the sort of thing about the attack at the time was that the couple were in the wrong place at the wrong time. It wasn't their fault. There was some speculation that their groceries had attracted the bear and that kind of thing at the time. But that was later dismissed because, so, you know, millions of people go into the wilderness with groceries and they don't get attacked by bears. So we were paddling. They actually were in a small motorboat when they went, but we were paddling and took their route. And I was just thinking about that, how they were in the wrong place at the wrong time. And I turned, I'd always been on the Lake Opiongo. It's like the biggest lake in Algonquin Park. I'd always been there in the summer when the best campsites are along the east side, because then you get to watch the sunset directly over in the west and it's excellent. And I noticed those were empty and I was like, oh, maybe we should take one of those because I've never got to watch the sunset from those great campsites. But we kept on and we pulled up to Bates Island where the attack happened. And I turned around and I looked and realized why the couple were on that island, because at that time of year, October, the sun had shifted over and they were perfectly positioned to see the sunset from there. And I just thought, that's kind of it. Like you don't know what's going to happen next, and you have to be, you know, maybe they were in exactly the place they wanted to be in that moment. That's conjecture, but that's sort of the best you can do. Is like right home and be in the best place. but I didn't set out to try and uncover that kind of thing, but the book, writing the book, did kind of show me the way in, I guess, you know, I guess if you open yourself out and turn yourself outward, and it was really driven by curiosity for me, that was sort of the thing that helped me be brave.
And how do you, towards the end of the book, you mentioned that running became something that became a part of your life, because you couldn't do certain other things, but how do you stay out of the sun these days?
So, right now I'm sort of, I've turned into a bit of a sundial. So I've decided that, 'cause there's not many, people with my condition, like it tends to be in the Scottish diaspora. There's Australians, you know, Scottish Australians who have much higher, you know, because of the climate there, much higher rates of skin cancer. So in a way, I'm lucky I'm in dark old Canada. But I go running 2 hours before sunset. And I, you know, I write and I run, and that's kind of my two things. So like I'll go after this tonight, and I usually go by Lake Ontario and I watch the sun drop. That's because it's like summer solstice time, but in December 22nd, I'll leave at like 2:04 in the afternoon because the sun sets at 4. So I just sort of move my running time according to the season and the UV specifically. But it's been kind of incredible because that's like a limitation, you know, the idea of creative constraints, like that you put a few rules and it like helps you actually create things. I've kind of done that to my life. So I, you know, I'm careful about UV. I try and go when the UV rating is about 2, I go outside. But it means that I've been going to like wilderness areas in November when no one else is there. And so you see all kinds of animals and like the trails are empty when it's raining, as it turns out. So I've just rediscovered all these places that I thought I knew, you know, and I'm seeing them in entirely different ways. And your friends will always go hiking with you in the rain and things if you just ask, as it turns out. So it was, I had loss, and I still experience loss, but I've found a lot of things too.
I mean, yeah. it's an unexpected gift, I think.
Yeah, and it's focusing, I think so many people with any kind of chronic condition or limitation, which is going to be all of us at some point, the trick really I've found is focusing on what you can do rather than what you can't. It's so, and my first couple of years were really focused on how my life had changed and what I couldn't do. And that takes a certain amount of being brave, I think, to reorient yourself like that.
Well, as one of the central characters in your book, and meeting you for the first time, it makes me very happy that you've found this place in the face of all of these potentially terrible things. So I think I have just a couple other questions. I want to be respectful of your time and your run.
Yeah, that's great.
One is, and we've talked about this on this show before, but I think it's important to talk about a lot. Literally, how do you survive a black bear attack, Claire?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, that's actually another part of this book is that when I first sort of was pitching the title in house to my publisher and things, they were thinking it was more sort of like a bit arty. And I was like, no, 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 this is literally like, I want people to know what to do around bears when they read this book. And that partly came because I usually find a way to get a bear in my book, and every book I've written, all my novels and things. And people always ask me if I see a bear, what do I do? You know? So actually, it kind of is a bit of a lengthy explanation because it depends. I mean, if you're in the Catskills, it's going to be a black bear. And so I talk about the difference between black bears and grizzlies, which is really important to distinguish the two. And with a black bear, I mean, they are So just to put this attack into perspective, there's one black bear attack that ends in a fatality a year in North America around. So there's been, we're at one already this year. There was one in Florida. I think that, you know, maybe there's one or two. They're going up slightly because there's like a positive relationship between the number of people in the outdoors and also the black bear population is growing. So those two things means there's conflict. But with bears, it's really about giving them space, about taking care of your garbage, especially in an area like yours, making sure that the bins are shut and the bears can't get into things, because bears follow their stomach and they will be where there's readily available food. So it's really about prevention and preventing conflict over food that way. But the other thing with the black bear is in these very rare circumstances, whereas a lot of with grizzlies, you know, they're huge. They can weigh up to 1,000 pounds. They have like 5-inch claws on the, you know, on their paws. So they can just do a defensive swipe and kill you. They weren't necessarily setting out to do that. There's the occasional black bear, like the one in my book, that will actually go after humans as prey. Very unusual. But it does happen. And so in that case, you want to stand tall and not be an easy target. So it's actually a matter of, well, when I went through bear training, I was tree planting. So they told us to like hold our shovel tall and not look like a deer fawn. That was the sort of the joke, but it wasn't a joke. You want to stand up for yourself. Because they're making a calculation. The other interesting thing, and I have a few YouTube videos that I point to and things in the book, is that a black bear, when they're stalking you or making an approach with prey intention, they don't look aggressive. And they don't. They look, it. Stephen Herrero, who's a bear expert, describes it more like a cat chasing a mouse. It's almost playful. And it's quite, I mean, when I see it, it's quite unnerving, but you don't, I think it can be mistaken for other things. So it's like that cat, like trying to close the gap between, you know, get closer and closer. That's what they tend to do. So it's great to have air horns or, groups of people is a great defense too. They generally, I mean, a bear attacking two people is extremely rare. It's off the charts. So being in groups is a great way to protect yourself as well.
Do you?
But it's, I mean, yeah?
No, go ahead. No, continue. Sorry.
I was going to say that one thing I sort of deal with is the rareness of this attack. And I think one of the tricks to living in a place like the Catskills, such a beautiful place, is not worrying about being attacked by a bear too much. You know, it's like educate yourself and know what you're dealing with. But there are, you know, it's getting into the car every morning that you should worry about. That's what's truly dangerous. And heart attacks and strokes are dangerous. And so are bee stings and dog bites.
So I'm very glad you brought that up, and I want to commend you for being very, especially for somebody who just wrote a book called How to Survive a Bear Attack. I understand that at every moment you're trying to pull people back from, you know, the Jaws effect, which I think is wonderful. You have to.
I just reread Jaws. Oh my gosh, because that's exactly it. That book is the shark isn't a shark in that book. That shark is a reflection of human fears, right? And that's what. This bear, because I didn't know who he was. He was like this dark shape in a horror film. It took writing this book to get to know him and realize he's a bear. He's not some nightmare. Yeah.
So I hope that this will end on a positive note, but I guess it depends on your answer. how do you feel these days about bears and humans coexisting in all of these? You know, we used to talk about bears in rural spaces. They're now as much in urban spaces.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
And luckily, as a fan of bears, like we've seen a growth in the bear population after we almost put them out of business 100 years ago. So this thing is, I think, happening maybe for the first time in kind of our modern culture and world. And I just wonder whether you're feeling good about that or not so good.
Oh, I'm feeling good. I think we can do it. I do. I really, I mean, this bigger picture, I think we're probably in some short-term trouble right now. But bigger picture, I think we have to understand that we're not in charge of the earth. You know, that there's, it is our home and we have to look after it or we're not going to be here. You know, it's, and bears are very much part of that. I think we can, by respecting them, I hope a reader comes out of, away from reading my book with a respect and understanding of what a bear's like, life is like, and that we can start to learn to coexist with them. I've talked to more and more people who see that as a reasonable thing that we should try and do. And that makes me very hopeful. Yeah, and that we leave space for them and that we appreciate wild things is such an important part of being human, I hope.
Well, good. I'm glad you ended on a positive note. I appreciate that. So Claire Cameron's new book is called How to Survive a Bear Attack, a memoir. You can find it, of course, at your favorite library or bookstore. Thank you so much, Claire. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Justin. I appreciate it, too.
Thank you.
This is Ginger Radio Hour. You've been listening to WGXC Acre 90.7 FM. I think you've already learned the most important thing for today: the strength to be brave and how to survive a black bear attack, which hardly ever happens. Here's some more music.
To be